This is a download from the Scottish Railway Preservation Society.
Just putting some lights on the engine now. We've got two lights showing it's a passenger train.
This is Soundworks, the magazine for railway enthusiasts around the world, coming to you from Bowness in Scotland.
Hello and welcome to this, the 13th edition of Sound Blast, the Scottish Railway Preservation Society's download, the totally non-visual magazine. I'm Sandy Simpson and I'm right here in Bowness in central Scotland with the indefatigable David Bytheway, the editor, producer and roving reporter for Sound Blast. In this edition, we'll be revealing news of a splasher, learning about railway mania in Scotland, going to an 80th birthday party and visiting Mike Yodeluk's steam archives in the company of David Bytheway. But first, he flies through the air with the greatest of ease, that daring young man in the new HCT. That daring young man is the perennially youthful-looking Donald McLeish, head of the Signals and Telegraph Department on the Society's Bowness and Kinneil Railway.
I'm standing in front of a squat, brightly painted yellow machine on the track here. That indicates that it's not a passenger-carrying vehicle, but it does have a small cab in the front which will carry four people. However, I've got somebody here with me who can tell me a little bit about it.
Hello, I'm Scott Cameron. I'm a member of the SRPS Diesel Group, and what I'm looking at just now is a British Rail HCT, or High Capacity Trolley. I know that name doesn't describe much. What it is basically is a scissor lift on a rail-mounted vehicle. It was used by British Rail to maintain the overhead line and any tunnel inspections or any other suitable work. And it's since been retired and it's now found its way to Bowness.
When it came here, it wasn't in full working order. You've had to do a bit of work on it, I believe.
That's right, yes. When it did first arrive, I'm not sure when it last run, but it didn't arrive in running condition, so we've had to do a fair bit of maintenance and remedial work to get it to move.
If we go around the back, there's a compartment which looks like it might be the engine compartment, so let's have a look inside.
Well, what we're looking at here is we're looking at the power plant for the machine. That's basically a six-cylinder Volkswagen diesel engine. It's fitted across the back of the vehicle and it basically drives a hydraulic pump.
And that'll be on the opposite side?
Basically on the drive end of the engine there's a hydraulic pump. And that's inside the hydraulic compartment of the machine, so everything on the machine is driven by hydraulics. The drive functions, the lift and the slew functions.
Okay, let's start it up. Now, before we go up onto the platform, we've got to fit the spring stabilisers. So, we need to put the turntable down, is that right?
That's correct. What we need to do is we basically need to raise the vehicle off the track. And it's fitted with a turntable underneath, which allows it to jack itself up off the track. And we can basically put locking pins in the suspension units, which basically makes it, you know, rigid on the track. It makes it more stable when we're up at height.
Okay, well, let's try that. This is a beam coming down from the machine, which is then turned 90 degrees to latch onto the railway track. It then carries on up and lifts the machine off the line. In this position, you could actually rotate the entire machine round to face the other way.
That's correct, that's how the vehicles were operated on the main line. There's only a driving cab at one end, so in the case of having to go long distance down the opposite direction, you could raise the vehicle off the ground, rotate it by hand through 180 degrees, lower it back down onto the tracks, and then you will be pointing our way.
Okay, great. Okay, that's the suspension supports in, so we can lower the machine onto the track. Right, we've climbed up onto the platform here, which is quite roomy, about 8 foot by 5 foot, and the machine can clamp onto the track to make for extra stability, so let's do that.
Here we are up the top, we're looking at the control panel. Press this little green button here. What's happening just now is the hydraulics are engaging a set of clamps onto the rail head. Gives us a bit more stability and allows the platform to extend out over the centre of gravity of the machine.
Good, right, let's go up. Right, we're slowly rising up. It's very smooth. In fact, it's so smooth you can imagine that the world is sinking. But we're rising now above the rooftops of the diesel locomotives and the carriages. How high up does this actually go?
This takes us up to about 6 metres off the height of the railhead.
Okay, it seems higher. We're right up at rooftop height now, still going. Very smooth. Oh, this is really fantastic. Still going up. It's just a bird's eye view of the entire site here. You can begin to see beyond the boundaries of the site, and that's us.
That's us. Full extension.
Okay. It certainly seems higher than, 20 odd feet, but it's quite stable. You could certainly get a fair bit done here. And it's got another trick. The platform now goes out sideways. So part of the platform's extending outwards to the side. And this go, how far out will this go?
This will take us out about 3 metres, 3 metres off the side of the machine.
3 metres, that's about 10 feet. And yeah, that really is beginning to be standing over open space. There's nothing beneath, it there.
That's about as far as I want to go.
Okay. We've now lowered down a little bit, but the machine can actually be driven from this control panel up here back and forth along the track. So let's have a try at that. Sorry. Before we can drive forward, we've obviously got to disengage the clamps. So, right. So now we can drive forwards.
Yep. With the clamps released, we can now engage the forward lever. The little red light disappears. It tells you your parking brake's off. Quick sound of the horn to warn everyone we're about to move. And advance the throttle. And off we go.
Yep. And what's the max? Whoa. What's the speed we can do along here?
The maximum speed when the platform's elevated and the suspension locks are in are 5 miles an hour.
Yeah, okay. And backwards now. That's us back down again. So thanks very much to Scott Cameron for showing us some of the functions of this very useful machine.
That was Donald McLeish with his head, and the rest of him, in the air. Next, we usually associate Railway Mania, with initial capitals, Railway Mania, with England during the 1840s. But John McGregor, the well-known writer and historian, told David, by the way, that Railway Mania, small letters this time, was rampant in the Scottish Highlands during the latter years of the 19th century.
John Cameron of Lough Eel in the 1890s was a promoter of the West Highland Line, and he said that they were experiencing a latter-day railway mania. What did he mean by that?
He wanted Parliament to recognise that railway schemes in the West Highlands were multiplying and that they were deserving of Parliament's attention and possibly, in some cases, of government assistance, such as had been recommended by the Napier Commission.
So let's paint a picture of what the railway landscape was like in the 1890s in the West Highland area.
The biggest single change was the success of the West Highland promotion. The West Highland Railway to Fort William was building between 1889 and 1894. And in many ways, this stimulated debate. Would it obtain government assistance to continue to the West Coast? Obviously, in the far north, there were other schemes with, shall we say, a similar agenda. Schemes for lines to Alt Bay, Lough Lexford, Lough Inver, Ullapool. If the West Highland could establish a precedent for subsidy, then at least optimistic promoters thought the sky's the limit. Government was inclined to be more sympathetic.
What were the views of the landowners to the development of railways? Were they all for railways coming across their patch, or did they oppose the railways?
Undoubtedly, one needed at least the appearance, if not the substance, of a landlordly consensus. And one of the secrets of West Highland success was that they were able to produce that consensus at least long enough to get the scheme through Parliament. But it involved considerable concessions to, for example, Lord Breadalbin, the Marquess of Breadalbin, who achieved special clause for his interests, protection of the salmon pools in the River Orkney, disturbance to his deer forest, £1,000 in his back pocket.
One of the lines which was put forward at the time was the Glasgow and Northwestern Railway. Now, why was this one so important?
I think because it, as it were, sets up the situation which Lochiel was describing. The Glasgow and Northwestern is ambitious, over-ambitious, but it is unlike other schemes for a westerly route north from Glasgow, which had come, gone, come again over the decades. This one is serious. It's well thought out. It gets as far as Parliament, even though it's defeated, and it leaves behind it a legacy of suspicion, manoeuvre, what happens next, especially with the possibility of government subsidy in people's minds.
So who was behind the Glasgow and Northwestern Railway?
That remains something of a mystery. It was, on the face of things, a contractor's line. It was a speculative venture. Certainly the promoters calculated that they would draw in one or more of the existing Scottish companies as it were, persuade them to take up the scheme in whole or part and buy them out. That is how a contractor's line worked.
What was the view of the two main rivals, the Caledonian and the North British, to this new venture?
They might have made common cause to take over the Glasgow and Northwestern jointly, but in fact they didn't. The North British dithered between supporting it and going through the motions of supporting it in order to win concessions for through traffic by the existing line via Perth, where the Caledonian had a great advantage. I think dither describes the North British position, and the Caledonian was able to make common cause with the Highland Company. They were the two, if you like, most immediately threatened, and their alliance held firm in Parliament. Again, that's a big difference when the West Highland came along. The Highland, with Inverness not directly threatened this time, the Highland comes to terms with the West Highland, leaving the Caledonian to fight on alone in defence of Oban. Now, that's a difference. Against the Glasgow and Northwestern, Caledonian and Highland made common cause. When the West Highland comes along, the North British, in supporting the West Highland, is able up to a point to achieve divide and rule.
Let's just trace the line. The line comes from Glasgow, then along Loch Lomond, up to Craonlarich, and then over to Fort William and up the Great Glen to Inverness. It got as far as Parliament, you said, so why did it fail?
Because the Highland and the Caledonian are resolute in defence, and it is too blatantly an outside scheme. They hadn't prepared the ground properly. Again, the West Highland promoters learned lessons from that.
And if it had gone ahead, how would it have shaped Scottish the railway landscape in Scotland?
Oh, I think it would have made a huge difference. And it would probably have led to a regrouping of Anglo-Scottish partnerships as well. if you want to play the game of might have been. I think the might have beens could be profoundly important.
Next, a short history lesson. The North British Railway Class K was a class of 30 four-furrow locomotives designed by William P. Reed with 6-foot driving wheels for mixed traffic work, which included perishable goods such as fish from Mallaig and Aberdeen. Built by the NBR in Cowley's Works between 1913 and 1920, the last of the class to be withdrawn by British Railways in November 1961 was 62496 Glenloy. You probably know that 62469 Glen Douglas was preserved, repainted in NBR livery in 1959 with its original number 256, and is on display in Glasgow. You probably didn't know that a splasher from Glenloy has recently been restored by Bob Smith, as Stuart Seller explained to David Bytheway.
This splasher came from the last glen to be broken up at Arnott Young's scrapyard at Old Kilpatrick in Dunbartonshire. It's from Glenloy, and it's a complete splasher. It's not just the side, it's the complete splasher itself.
Now let's explain what a splasher actually is.
A splasher, just like a motorbike or a pushbike, is what covers the wheel and prevents all the water and what have you, muck, from splashing up over everything else. And at the time it was quite a mammoth exercise. It's some weight. And I had to hire a van and bring it through to Falkirk, and it lay rusting away at Falkirk for years and years and years. But luckily it survived a move down here to Bowness, and at last has been restored and will take its place in the museum alongside the flame cut, as they call it, splasher from Ben Alder.
Mention Bowness Station to anyone with any connection with the Bowness and Kinneil Railway, and you'll probably be asked, how is Peter Howell? Well, the very long-serving senior station master at Bowness retired from that titular position recently, though he's still to be found in and around the station almost as much as ever he was. And the indefatigable David Bytheway caught up with the tireless and ageless Peter as he was celebrating his 80th birthday with a birthday bash at Bowness Station. Where else?
With me now is Peter Howell, and we're in the LNER buffet, and we're celebrating your 80th birthday. As you can hear in the background, there's lots of people drinking coffee and stronger stuff, and Peter's standing with me just now. So happy birthday, first of all, Peter.
Thank you very much, David.
Now, tell me, you've been a lifelong fan of railways. What was it about railways that got you so interested in the first place?
I'm not really sure, but I used to have an auntie that lived overlooking the line to Enfield Town, and there used to be boring conversations between adults, and you could look out the window and see these trains go past in either direction. And then I discovered a footbridge where you could see railways at another place, and my mother always blamed her arthritis on standing there and getting cold. And so it progressed from there. And when I was at school, I used to go on trips around Stratford Works and farther afield sometimes. And when I moved up to Scotland, it was amazing that you could go round sheds and nobody threw you out. Initially, I think I was more inclined towards traction engines because I thought it seemed so desperately hard to get the people who are interested in railways interested in doing something about all the disappearing stuff. So initially I turned my attention towards traction engines and steamrollers. But I did used to go and help John Hunter down at the Murrayfield when we had a little exhibition, a little outfit down at Murrayfield Station in Edinburgh.
Do you like the engineering or the coaches?
I like the way they work, and it's such a comprehensive, and yet it all functions and everybody knows what their part and role is. And it happens. I think it's running the railway is a highly disciplined operation.
You said that you've been following railways since you were a boy. Give me one outstanding memory.
Oh, so many. Where I went to college, we had a railway society, and we were good fortune to have some ex-Imperial College people who were high up in the railways, and We hired one of these Great Western rail cars and went all the way down from London to the pumping stations for the Severn Tunnel. And that was a fantastic day. We saw all these beam engines working to pump out the Severn Tunnel. I think that's something I'll never forget.
You joined the SRPS, didn't you? How long ago was that?
Oh, I don't think I really joined until it was either late 60s or early 70s. I certainly was around in time to when we had made the decision of not to go to Strathspey. But
and what do you think of the society's work down at Bowness? Has it done enough? Does it warrant the achievement that everyone says, or is it just a poor reflection of some of the societies in England?
Well, we've never had any sugar daddies, but I think we've achieved quite a lot. But I think we need to now focus on the next 5 years as to what we're going to do. Are we going to make the railway two-ended by having an accessible platform manual that people can join the train there and come down to Bowness? I think we should, because now we've not got the mine, the whole... what you might call inclusive attraction is being diminished, and I really do think we need to work on making the railway two-ended, and I also think we should blow our trumpet more about the museum.
And finally, David, by the way, has been to visit Mike Yodelick's archive of recordings of steam locomotives at work. So let's wallow in nostalgia for a few minutes.
First, let's go back to 3rd September 1966. BR Scottish Region had organised a last A4 excursion from Glasgow Buchanan Street to Aberdeen, what was to be the last of the three-hour A4 hauled service trains. In this on-train recording, we hear 60019 Bittern starting away from Stonehaven Station on the return journey, crossing a viaduct and climbing away on the 1 in 92 gradient. Next, we hear a BR Caprotti Standard Class 5460, number 73149, making a noisy departure from Stirling Station on a Dundee West to Glasgow Buchanan Street passenger train on 17 September 1966. On this final recording, we're travelling in a brake van on the West of Fife and Clickmannan Jai 36 rail tour on 22nd October 1966. It's hauled by Jai 36, number 65288, and we hear the departure from Limpet Ness near Rosyth Docks and the noisy climb through the tunnel towards Inverkeithing Docks. Thank you.
Ah, yes, those recordings bring memories. And thank you, Mike, your luck, and thank you, David, by the way. And that pretty well wraps up this edition of Sound Blast. You can contact us online at www.srbs.org.uk/soundblast, all lowercase. That's www.srbs.org.uk/soundblast. Or you can write to us at Sound Blast, two words this time with initial capitals, Sound Blast, SRBS, Union Street, Bowness, West Lothian, EH519AQ, Scotland. The tireless roving reporter, editor and producer has been David, by the way. And I'm Sandy Simpson, wishing you all that you wish yourself from everyone here at the Scottish Railway Preservation Society at Bowness in Scotland.
And finally, as this programme is being made just before Christmas, we brought together the massed choirs of the Bowness and Kinneil Railway to wish you a Merry Christmas.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Good tidings we bring to you and your kin.